And of course, there's always interesting, intriguing physics of a short film. Now, if you're a theorist and you don't mind doing simulations, then you know there is a very powerful piece of artillery in the toolbox of a theorist, namely path integral Monte Carlo. We've heard already a lot of it, so I will not spend time on the details. It's very powerful to study both systems. It was pioneered, of course, by David Zeppeli, who has introduced us to the method yesterday. If you want to know the detail, his review paper is now a classic. I am going to endorse what was just said in the discussion. This method is accurate. People would venture to say in our community that it is exact. By exact, we mean that statistical and systematic error are under control. So at least in principle, they can be reduced arbitrarily given enough CPU time. That's very different than doing approximate calculations where you are not able to gauge the quantity, the magnitude of the error. It's something you learn to appreciate with time. There is no adjustable parameter. I completely endorse this statement. There is, for example, no trial wave function. It is true what people argue sometimes, that you tend to get back the physics you have put in. That would be, I think, true to some extent with ground state calculations, where you do have to provide a trial wave function. At finite temperature, the only input is the microscopic model, which doesn't depend on who does the calculation. Those potentials exist regardless of path integrals. Another huge advantage of path integral Monte Carlo is that it allows the direct computation of both the superfluid and the condensate fraction at finite temperature. These are both measurable quantities. Superfluid density, of course, by torsional oscillator, condensate fraction by neutron diffraction. Of course, it's a numerical calculation, which means that you have to deal with problems having to do with the fact that you are simulating a finite system. So you have to deal with the finite size in the appropriate way. Now, I would submit to you that we can do something along those lines, but I would prefer not to give detail. We can certainly talk, but there will be a talk by my collaborator next week who will be talking some about this. So,
he wanted to know the
truth. Oh, I see. Yeah.
It's the wrong song.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I don't know how good a pickup line would be, but I mean, it's certainly. So I would like to talk today about what I would regard as a possibly significant technical advance, which has been achieved recently, which seems to overcome one of the most important limitations. Existing path integral technology, namely its size limitation. Let me qualify this statement. There is really no size limitation for most quantities. I mean, the current technology we've heard about is perfectly capable of providing accurate estimates on most, if not all, thermodynamic quantities for reasonable size systems. The superfluid density has proven hard to compute for systems, I would say, for the sake of argument, with n greater than something like 100. It's not so much that it is hard to get to 100, it's that the scaling doesn't seem very favorable if you increase the size of the system. So we have started developing this algorithm precisely to tackle this particular problem. But by doing that, we have also managed to achieve some technical improvements that have been sought after within our community by different people over the past decade. For example, to my knowledge, this is the first fully grand canonical method that includes completely quantum statistics. Now, I'll be talking about solids, and the fact that you're in the grand canonical ensemble is not really much of an advantage there, but in principle it could be of interest. It allows the simultaneous calculation of structural energetic properties as well as off-diagonal properties. Now, with the current technology, usually you have to do separate simulations if you are interested in off-diagonal or diagonal quantities. One of these off-diagonal quantities is the Matsubara-Green function, which, as you shall see, you basically get it for free from the calculation, as well as, of course, as the one-body density matrix. Now, the most important message is the efficiency gain in the calculation of the superfluid density. And we have obtained results, which I will show you, for systems that can be now as large as several thousand. And that, of course, allows, among other things, an accurate determination of the transition temperature. So in order to convince you that there is something to this, I will first review the superfluid transition very briefly, essentially by showing results in liquid helium-4, and then I'll talk about application to commensurate solid helium-4. And again, I would like to emphasize the commensurate here for the same reasons we heard from David right now. It's always the same. I haven't picked another transition. So I will go very fast here because we have heard already what this is all about. In path integral Monte Carlo, the idea is that you calculate thermal averages of a certain physical quantity, which is represented by an operator, at some finite temperature T, and the textbook rule is that you have to calculate a trace, and R is a collective coordinate for all the particles in the system, and rho is what you use at finite temperature instead of the wave function, which is the many-body density matrix. Now, this object is very complicated. It's unknown in general, but there is a recipe due to Feynman. You can approximate the full density matrix with a multidimensional integral where you use this particular object, the product of something that basically is mapped to a higher temperature. I'm calling P here what Bernard called M, but basically that's the idea. And rho naught is the many-body density matrix at a higher temperature. What is the point here? That you can obtain reasonably good approximations. There are better, worse approximations, but in principle, all of them give you the same limit as long as you're willing to take, a sufficiently large number of time slices or of slices. Now, whenever you have a multidimensional integral, of course, a natural candidate is Monte Carlo. And the way technically you achieve this computational goal is by generating on a computer a set of paths. Okay, and you can see these. Each one of these is the position of all the particles in your system, which have to be sampled from this probability density. Once you know how to generate this, you can calculate all of your averages as essentially statistical averages over this set, which can be generated with well-known technology, namely the Metropolis algorithm. Now, this is fairly general. Of course, the implementation differs by the way the paths are sampled. That is what can make crucial differences. So the worm algorithm was invented by Nikolai Prokofiev, Boris Svistunov, and Igor Tupitsin in 1998 in the context of lattice models. Okay? Only recently it has been extended to continuous systems. The very basic idea has to do with what Bernard was describing right now. So we use word line to represent particle positions at different imaginary times between zero and beta. So suppose this is a one-dimensional system, and these are positions of four particles at tau equal to zero. And then these word lines, you see, can wind around because particles are indistinguishable, and therefore they can permute. And the positions occupied by the four particles at zero and beta are the same, but it is possible for them to have exchanged. And if this were traditional path integral Monte Carlo, all of the fifth line would also be closed. Okay? In the worm algorithm, you work in an extended configuration space, which includes one open word line, which is the blue one, which is called the worm. So the head and the tail of the worm can both advance and recede in imaginary time, which means that at some positions, you have one missing particle. So this is one reason why we say we work in the grand canonical ensemble. There is an additional reason, and I'll get to it in a minute. There is no real time. The imaginary time is because e to the minus beta h can be seen as the time evolution operator of quantum mechanics, but in imaginary time. So that is why we it should not be taken as time in a physical
after you do analytic calculation, you can recover real time. Okay.
Trivial, straightforward analytic continuation. Yeah.
Four linear spots.
Absolutely right. Yeah. Sure.
I heard this is diffusive quantum Monte Carlo. Can I use diffusive quantum Monte Carlo?
Diffusion quantum Monte Carlo is a method that at t equals zero, I'm at finite temperature.
But what's the major difference between diffusive and path integral?
Other than the fact that one is at t equals zero and the other is finite temperature, they're the same. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, they're really different. They're different. Yeah, I mean, at t equals zero, the main difference is that any method that works at t equals zero, you have to supply a trial wave function because you project the exact ground state of an initial trial wave function. we don't have to worry about anything like that here. Okay, what are the basic issues with the worm algorithm? Technically, I'll be happy to talk to you at great length about the details. The one important aspect is it is based on local moves only that only involve the worm. In other words, you don't touch any of these lines. You only do manipulations through the head and the tail of the worm. One important aspect is that the head and tail can perform the so-called swap. In other words, you see here I have my initial configuration. This is my final configuration, which is identical, except that I have grown a piece of path here and I have connected my worm to this word line, which now becomes a legitimate particle word line, and the worm has moved right here. So this way, head and tail can diffuse both in spatial and imaginary time arbitrarily. We design this. This leads to a very efficient way of sampling permutations. It eliminates one of the most important aspects of sampling permutations in the canonical ensemble, because you never have to bring any two particles close to each other within the hardcore distance of the potential. That leads to a lot of rejection in the regular path integral Monte Carlo. So we have designed a number of moves, elementary moves, in complementary pairs in order to satisfy detailed balance. The swap move, this one, is self-complementary. Otherwise, we have open and close the worm, and advance and recede for either one of the two heads and tail.
There's a question here. Over there, your vertical axis, that you're drawing as if it's a continuum, but of course, you've got discrete numbers.
Absolutely.
Well, maybe that's, I don't know, 50 steps or something. But how many steps between on the vertical axis? You have J and then J plus M. Give me a number. So, like is J like 5? Is J plus M 10? Are you leaving out 2 steps where there seems to be a variable?
Okay, very good. So what we typically do is the following. You sample a possible reconnection within a certain range. Okay, so for example, you decide I'm gonna allow as much as this length over which to sample a reconnection. Okay? And then you sample a particular within that particular interval, you try from 1 to
I need numbers.
What temperature depends on the temperature, on the density, depends on the, it's problem dependent. It's physical condition dependent. Shall we say superfluid helium at the, okay, so I would say, actually I could say probably a good rule of thumb I found is beta over 4. How's that? Yeah. But then again, it depends on how much what acceptance you're willing to live with. With beta over 4, the longest swaps have still an acceptance of 25%. If I were willing to live, oh no, that's very high. Acceptance is still very high. If I were willing to live with even lower acceptance, I could probably do the entire beta. But again, it depends on the particular system. So now the configurations with an open word line do not contribute to most of the observables because they are diagonal. They contribute to the Matsubara Green function, and we call this the G sector. In other words, all the configurations where we have an open worm open line. All the non-trivial topological modifications of word lines occur in the G sector. The swap moves enjoy relatively high acceptance, even if you have a hardcore potential, because you never have to bring two particles within short distances. The head and the tail can reconnect, and that results in a diagonal configuration. Every time you have a diagonal configuration, this contributes to the partition function. So you are in the Z sector. Okay. Say that again, sir. No, sir. They do actually get together. What you have is you attempt periodically the reconnection, and it works because you know in a superfluid you have a maximum of the one body density matrix at the origin.
So the difference apart from this work. So you also don't do the kind of exchange that Dave does, that because he has exchange only when the particles come together, but you don't even do that, you just do the worm moving.
The exchange only comes as a result of part of head and tail reconnecting after a number of swaps, and at that point you get immediately cycles that are very large.
So
it's different. Yeah, well, yeah. So the number of particles fluctuates, so the word lines can disappear and can be recreated, because I can have head and tail annihilate, or I can create a new worm and have it grow. Head and tail can go past each other, in which case you have an additional particles. But these are essentially details. There are also versions like the one I'm using, where I'm always between n minus 1 and n particles. Now, it should be noted that the worm algorithm was not invented in the context of quantum Monte Carlo. It's a general algorithm of statistical mechanics, and it has been applied to a number of quantum and classical lattice models. One of the most notable things that have been demonstrated is that there is no critical slowing down for easing model. And you may argue, well, but there are many other algorithms. Yes, true, but they are cluster algorithms. This is a local algorithm.
So this is the IT model.
Yes. Also, yeah. Absolutely. They have been. All of that has been done because when they tested this particular statement, I don't know actually if it has been proven in general, but certainly they found it for easing model. And I guess the conventional wisdom. Yes, sir.
You know, so my point is no critical slowing down for IC model.
Yeah.
That means also no critical slowing down for X1 model or
high. I am not ready to make that statement. I don't know if that has been verified. I would expect that.
Yeah,
yes, it has been verified. Yes. Because I know for X1 model or O3 model, there's this wolf engine, it's a cluster engine.
Yes, it's a critical slowing down.
Yes, and this is at least as good as it might even be better.
Better than wolf
engine. Yes.
In terms of scaling, it has a slightly larger
big factor, but the scaling is better than wolf engine.
Oh. So this is a two dimensional.
Yeah.
One is completely
eliminated. Yeah, but you mean you eliminate it. Z is zero or
it is? Z is zero.
Zero.
So that's some log scaling.
Anyway, we're getting away from super solid.
Yes, sir.
But about the Asima, no, sorry.
Could I ask you some critical slowing down a failure or success?
Yeah.
It's a failure. No, it's a success. It's a success.
Experiment happened, right?
True. Experiment, true. But you don't want on a computer to see what happens already in the experiment, because you might as well do the experiment.
Although you don't see critical slowing down, you are still able to compute the exponent.
Look, what we do... Moses, we are not trying to have on the computer a repetition of what happens in real time in the lab. We are trying to explore configuration space to have good statistics. We want to do that quickly and efficiently. I am totally cheating. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so since I have been going on and on about this, let me show you about some results. Okay, we start by reproducing what has been done already to see if we can get any improvement. So this is the simulation of the superfluid transition of helium-4 in two mathematical dimensions. It's a well-defined problem. It was done first by Pollock and Seppel in 1989, and the open points are their numbers for the 25-particle system. These are our own numbers, and we go to significantly larger system sizes, up to 2,500 particles. Now, let me comment on this. You may say, well, okay, 1989, then 2006 is 17 years. Why aren't the computers just 100 times faster, okay? There's no question about it. There is some of that. The crucial aspect is the fact that we are calculating the superfluid density. The calculation of the superfluid density, as David has explained yesterday, requires the growing of these very long cycles that span the entire system. The effort for those is not linear, does not scale linearly with the number of particles. Okay, it has a much less favorable scaling. For this reason, this is particularly important, in my opinion. It is possible, this line that I have here is the theoretical Costa-Litz-Tauless limit, and we are approaching it fairly well at this level. We have enough points where, and the region where the system behaves close to criticality is much greater in this particular case, so we have a new estimate of the critical temperature. Now, let me show you also a similar figure to that to the one David showed yesterday. This is a typical configuration of two-dimensional helium, and there are many exchanges going on here, so I have to use a different color, otherwise I would never see them, but this is a long permutational exchange that involves 54 particles. And you see we have winding in both directions.
But maybe I could ask my question at this stage, although you haven't gone solid yet, but if you look at that picture, you see big voids in a two-dimensional liquid, right?
Yeah.
And those are not going to be present in the solid. And so what makes you think that the worm will be able to go around so well in the solid? Because there won't be those spaces in there for... Right?
Okay, I can offer an argument. Can I argue? We'll get back to that. Yes, I obviously have to address this.
But even what is the green
It's all the same particles. These are particles word lines. For example, this one seems fairly isolated. I don't know, but it seems isolated. So this would be the path of one particle if it doesn't exchange. I don't think so. Okay, so this would be one. Oh, this one would be one particle, okay? All right?
This is a snapshot.
It's a snapshot, of course, yes, absolutely. And these are all connected. In other words, if I were to follow the word line of this particle, it will not end where it started, but to another word line, and the, you know.
This is a long exposure snapshot that takes several paths.
Yeah. So let's look at three-dimensional helium, and here we have the black curve here. The continuous curve is experiment. These are our estimates, and we go from 64 all the way to 2048 particles in powers of 2. You see that as I increase the size of the system, the smearing of the phase transition becomes less and less pronounced, and I'm closer and closer to the reasonable description of the critical region right here.
Why is it that 3D seems to be better than 2D?
I mean, in what sense does it? No, but I think he says the rounding, even with 2,500 particles, before I had something that looked more round.
The exponents are different.
Yeah.
So it's just 2D is more difficult.
Yeah.
Cost in dollars is more difficult.
Yes, yeah. This is why we took that as an...
It's not more difficult. It depends on what you believe, though. The exponents are different. And if you use the exponents to correct it, it's not harder.
Cost is out of that correlation exponential.
Different result for given size or the finite size scaling result.
This is I'll show you the finite size scaling in the next. This 64, 128, 256, 512, 1024, 2048. So how do I determine the critical temperature in this particular case? So this is the winding number fluctuation and. It's a geometrical problem. I might as well have put the rho s, which is related to the winding number, but it's a geometrical property. Its fluctuations are a signature of a transition in the U1 universality class, which includes the XY model. Okay. So the idea is that you can determine TC by sort of looking at the intersection of all of these curves. Now, the curves only intersect in the very large L limit, where L is the square root of N. Okay, for N not so large, there are corrections to scaling. Okay, and so the determination of the intersection is a bit of a juggling act, involving also the fact that you know that the intersection has to occur in the infinite volume limit at the universal number, which has been calculated fairly accurately by simulation of the XY model, and you will notice that if I take, for example, the intersection of 64 and 128, the 128 and 512, and so on and so forth, it moves to the right, but then it seems to converge, and with this bound that I have here, we determine 2.193 with an error bar of 6. Now, the experimental transition temperature is 2.177. We don't expect the Aziz potential to be able to necessarily reproduce that number because this is not universal. Okay, so we expect that the different potential will give a different transition temperature. And it's interesting that we are apparently approaching the limit where we can actually test that for a particular potential. So far, potentials have been tested primarily with energetic and structural properties. And Aziz, of course, works very well. But this might be a more cogent test of a particular interaction.
Yet.
If you want, I am... Yeah, no, okay, so this, okay, is proportional to L multiplied by rho s divided by the mass temperature. So I'm looking at something that is, this is rho s multiplied by the size of the system. Yeah. Okay, fine, we can do large system size, but so what, okay? Now, it is true that very often you can surprisingly well approach the thermodynamic limit, for example, for the kinetic energy, just by simulating 30 particles, okay? But there are some physical quantities that do require large size extrapolations. For example, TC, or if you want to determine N0, the condensate fraction. For example, here I'm showing results for a system of 2,000 particles, and very close to the critical temperature. The blue data are obtained on a system of 64 particles. And whereas these data are for a system of 2,000 particles. And you see that here, that's where my simulation cell ends. And it is difficult to determine, you know, accurately the value of N0. Whereas if you have such a large system, and you see, I would like to pick up on the comment David was making yesterday, we can actually fairly comfortably get to 20 angstrom at this point. It becomes much more feasible. But I would like to stress, this is not just a matter of calculating things more accurately. That may be valuable in and of itself, but it is not the whole point. The issue is that there are some physical phenomena that can only be properly formulated or studied on sufficiently large system sizes. So, for example, if you're looking at possible superfluid layers at solid helium 4 grain boundaries, if you're looking at superfluidity in porous media, now maybe Vicor is not that bad from that point of view, but if one wanted to look at aerogel, where you have a much larger correlation length, then you would need much larger system sizes than what have been used so far. Now, if you're looking at dislocations or extended defects in quantum crystals, that's another application. Finally, polycrystalline samples. And I would encourage you, if you're interested, to follow the talk given by Boris Svistunov next week, who will be talking about some of these things. So let's go to why have I kept this in the end, because there is not really much to show here. I would ask you to ignore these, or if you don't want to ignore them, maybe you can ask me later, or again, Boris will be talking about that. This has to do with some recent work we've done. These are two calculations that are relevant to what we are discussing right now. In other words, we have a perfect HCP helium crystal. So it's exactly the same system Bernard was talking about. Okay? There are no vacancies, you know, there are... And the issue we wanted to address was whether it is possible to have a condensate in a system of this type. Okay?
But as you're moving, you have vacancies. When the worm is growing, right?
You're talking about between head and tail, yeah, there are vacancies in there, if you wish. Yeah.
So for a while there's vacancies and then they go away.
Yes, but understand, I never measure anything in those. So when I reconnect, that's when I make my measurement, and at that point there are no vacancies in the sense of commensurability.
Would you normally have the on the side where you have vacancies or interstitials? Which side do you sample from?
Vacancies. You can do both, but I do. I do vacancies, so I go from... I think so. So I am between my N minus 1 plus epsilon and N minus epsilon. No, epsilon is 1.
So the average is in the canonical...
The average is in the canonical... Yeah, when I close, I'm back to N particles. So the temperature here is 0.2, and we have about 800 particles. The superfluid signal is dead at zero, and what we find is that, and this is the spherically averaged one-body density matrix, the log of it, and we see that there is some oscillation at short distances due to coordination shell. But then when we do the spherical averaging, that those oscillations go away. We have here two densities, and I understand, yeah, David was right saying that, you know, there is a bit of cheating here. These are densities that, if I had the perfect potential, would correspond to a pressure of about 30 bars here and about 155 bars right there. If I were to calculate the pressure, I would find a small difference, not much, but a small difference for the reasons David was talking about. As you see, there seems to be maximum distance that we have here is 15 angstrom. There appear to be little doubt that this is decaying exponentially. So these results are absolutely consistent with what we heard from David yesterday and from Bernard now, namely that we don't have any evidence that a perfect commensurate crystal can have a Bose condensate. We are not saying anything about, we are not saying anything about vacancies, defects, interference, nothing at that time. It is just this particular targeted question. Yes, sir?
So the temperature is the liquid, whether the simulation goes faster or slower. Have you done at lower temperature?
But we found that below 1 Kelvin, it's very hard to see.
Right. We spent a long time basically below 1 Kelvin.
This is essentially ground state. This is essentially ground state.
So that has nothing to do with incremental
beam. That is incremental.
That is incremental.
Oh. There's no difference.
I mean, the temperature scale is the bifrequency, which is. It's like 40 Kelvin or whatever, and so once you well below there, it doesn't really matter.
So we haven't done lower than that, but they, to the extent they can see, there's no change lower than we've done.
You cannot go lower.
No. I mean, but it has to be worth your while and your CPU time. But I think that at 0.5, I would get the, within this scale. Within this, you wouldn't.
On a log scale, you wouldn't see the difference between each other. But
well, let's say take an incremental result as it is. Incremental result is saying that the PC is either 40 to the Kelvin. Or you know, the 200 is a very tail. We hardly see anything to respond.
Fair enough. So I can say that.
So I mean.
Fair enough. No question. There's. I can. I don't think I can. I can give you circumstantial evidence, but I, this is not. This is not. In other words, I can tell you that. Look, I can show. I can try to study as a function of temperature, and this doesn't seem to make any difference. Okay. But wait,
you're saying that there's no difference between 1 Kelvin and 0.5 Kelvin. That doesn't.
And 0.2. Point two.
So that doesn't really prove very much, right? Because incrementally, transition temperature, as some people would be saying,
okay,
it's 40 millikelvin.
Okay.
No, okay, first. Okay, Moses, there's one aspect.
Yes.
The fact that we have a finite system helps us in this case. Because a finite system will round all phase transitions, which means that you could have spillage of condensate, just like for the superfluid density.
Oh,
okay.
Finite size effect also push TC to lower temperature.
High.
In periodic gamma conditions, it goes up, not down.
Oh, so that has nothing to do
with
experiment then.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's not. It's a numerical calculation at finite, at small, low but finite temperature. There's no denying that. Yes, sir.
Well, but Colin Moses thought that when there's no helium free impurity, when you go below so many ppb, there's actually nothing.
Right.
Okay. So I'm wondering, this calculation, I guess you can put in one helium free impurity very easily.
Right.
Okay. But can you do two?
Well, maybe we should say this for the discussion. But do you have more?
I have just one.
I have one question.
Okay.
Just one. I also had one this question for you. You talk about the BEC. Now it's at k equal to 0. So they could have BEC at the finite length scale.
So n of k is a Fourier transform of that. It's not going to have any.
N of k is the Fourier transform. Yeah, you would have to have a plateau here in order to have a delta function at the origin in the n of k. Yeah.
But to have a delta function at some other value of k, you would have to have it on.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So you didn't see that. Some oscillation here.
No, but this is not.
This is on a log scale. We turn it on.
Why don't I conclude? Yeah.
How long did it take you to get that line here?
This one. This one. This with an error bar of 3 days, 10 days.
How many processors? How many processors?
Two.
Oh, two processors.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the technology
goes
down to effective
10 centimeters. Okay, but we are, this is a log scale. Okay, we are trying to calculate very small numbers with a sufficiently with a reasonable accuracy. So you know.
One thing if I might add that line there is consistent with the same line that Bernard showed up.
I'm sure it is.
Right. It's not like these two things are completely unrelated to each other.
Yeah. Well, why would
rho f and the exchange frequencies and the decay of n of r.
But why would they be unrelated?
Well,
okay. I mean, I thought they were related.
Yeah. The one is an off-diagonal correlation, and the other is not.
But isn't it just like N0 and Rho S? Okay, they are related in the sense that, you know.
Two dimensions, you have 1, 0, and the other.
It's power. That's the usual argument of the power. Like, okay, fine.
That's what we just said.
Would it be sensitive to three-body forces? If you give me a three-body force, I can put it in and we'll get slightly different numbers for the pressure. Will this change? I very much doubt it, but, you know, there's only one way to know. Yeah. I doubt very much if these things are sensitive to this type. The Aziz potential, essentially, the physics of helium is captured by the hard core of the potential. Hard sphere model gives a reasonably accurate description.
You know? It seems to me when you get the ends of two paths that come close to it, and there's already
two-body interaction at the end of the path, so it seems like the three-body force like to be able to two paths to the
you have to go back to the one who was showing equal times and tap intervals, the potential only interaction at equal times and the ends are at different times.
So I would say that the results are consistent with no evidence of Bose-Einstein condensation and superfluidity in a perfect HCP crystal, at least down to 0.2 Kelvin. Now we do have exchanges. Okay, I haven't really collected statistics, but we do see them. We do see primarily 3 and 4 particle permutations on the plane. However, we never see long permutation cycles that would give any non-zero winding. Now, and this is the answer to what you asked before, what David asked before. So we have these swap moves, okay? We do observe very large acceptance. In other words, the two ends are allowed to travel freely wherever they want, okay? However, when they reconnect, which takes for the solid much longer than for the superfluid, they do so only by coming back to the same identical word line. So that is what I would submit to you.
So you do the same thing we do and have a potential between the
ends. I could do it, but I don't do it.
No, but why wouldn't they just stay close together all the time?
They don't. Because it doesn't cost you anything to have a swap, because you never bring two particles close together. So we see ear and the head and tail go very far away, except that in order to come back, they will only come back when they close on the same identical word line. Whereas if it is a superfluid, they could come back and have long winding between the two. Say that again. Which we do.
Well, you're not right here, right? No, you don't restrict yourself to the canonical and
self. Don't branching at all. Your head and tail can possibly get out of touch.
So if I force them to be at a certain distance in imaginary time, is that what you're saying? Yes, they would. They will go, yeah, okay. They will not, and that's physics, okay?
Yeah.
But that's exactly, I thought that's what we're here for. I mean, it's a physical result. It's not an artifact of a computational, that's, you know.
How are
you have to wait. You have to wait, but you do get it. I mean, you have to wait some time, but you get it.
You would never get 10 to minus 6. That would take a million steps, right?
I can show it.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't have it here, but I can show it. Of course, you can use reweighting tricks and do stuff
like that. You don't do that. You just...
I don't. Nikolai does.
Oh.
Yeah.
Was it done to get that graph that you showed?
Excuse me?
This curve you showed. That would be similar to
that. The lower pressure, I did it, I didn't use it. The high pressure was use it. Probably, yeah.
Yeah, maybe that's the detail.
Can you adjust the copper to the similar thing to the fine? Because using vacancy, whether at all or not.
There is no problem with introducing vacancies. It's correct to state that we put them in by hand, but it's certainly possible to do the same calculation without introducing vacancies. With introducing vacancies.
Okay, can you give us some kind of physical idea why your model shows
Yes, so the canonical explanation is the following, is that in the liquid you build these exchanges, these long exchange cycles that have this effect of spanning the entire system size. As shown by David many years ago, that is related directly to the superfluid density defined as in linear response theory. The fact that permutations are so suppressed in the solid leads not only to suppression of individual permutations, but also to the disappearance of these long cycles that without which we cannot have this particular situation. The fact that you don't have these long cycles is also related to the fact that you don't have off-diagonal long-range order. Yeah.
I'm not sure your second statement. that the worm ends can move far apart, but they usually reconnect without leaving permutation behind. If you put a topological forbidden space in the middle of your cell, can you get these worm ends to swap, you know, and get a large reconnection around the topological?
Yes, absolutely.
In that case, you say unlike in a superfluid in that case, but is the topology of the configuration space let you?
Well, this is a torus. He is doing it on a torus.
Yeah,
so he does have a non-trivial topological. I would answer the opposite way. That you said, I guess the question is, in principle, if you had a superfluid, you would, but in the space, in principle, you only get the trivial.
Yeah, okay, I would like to, maybe it's worth clarifying here. You could have a situation in which the head and tail are just stuck very close together and never get far apart, okay? That's one problem. But the situation we're seeing is that head and tail are not close together, they travel around, but they can only come back reclosing on the identity permutation. So the simulation gets stuck, but that is because the head has to find the tail back, and it takes a non-trivial amount of time. But that's physics, okay? It's not a deficiency of the algorithm, or something that you can, without deficiency, something that you can attribute to the algorithm.
Did you look into
the interface? We are doing that. Boris Vistunov will be talking about it next week. I would like to mention that, in any case, this result of no Bose-Einstein condensation is consistent with general theoretical results for a commensurate crystals, and I would refer you to this particular paper. I checked it out. They say it starts. We prove, okay, and there is not much wiggle room there.
No, but there's no proof in the paper. That's all. That's the example. Yeah.
Today,
our
paper,
the sensitivity
paper, yeah,
that's right. People complain the talks are going too long, so I'm trying to. Some questions related to the talk here.
Anymore. When you measure for the object,
you always only measure the
situation where the same, when you have a full particle?
Well, you have half a particle here and half a particle there.
You only measure when it's exactly the entire outline of that number that maybe it goes to. You grow and shrink this.
Yeah.
When you said epsilon is like
one part, the Matsubara Green function. I don't have the results. We have, of course, that. Yeah. I don't have anything here.
Okay, so maybe we'll reconvene at 20 after.